From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Peter Jennings. He died yesterday, 4 months after ending an edition of ABC's World News Tonight by telling us he had lung cancer. We'll listen back to an interview we recorded in 1998 about his life and his career. Also today, Paul Anka looks back on the late 50s and early 60s when he was a teen idol with hits like Diana, You Are My Destiny, and Put Your Head on My Shoulder. And we'll talk about his new comeback record, which features swing versions of rock hits of the 80s and 90s, including songs by Nirvana and R.E.M. And we remember Ibrahim Ferrer, the Cuban singer who was rediscovered by Ry Cooder as part of the Buena Vista Social Club project. Ferrer died Saturday at the age of 78. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even though I knew he had lung cancer, I was stunned and, of course, very sad when I heard last night that Peter Jennings died. It was only 4 months ago that he left his anchor desk at ABC's World News Tonight after signing off by telling us about his illness. September would have marked his 22nd anniversary as the sole anchor of the program. From 1978 to 83, he served as the foreign anchor, sharing the anchor duties with Frank Reynolds and Max Robinson. With Jennings' death comes the end of an era in TV news. Within the past year, CBS anchor Dan Rather and NBC's Tom Brokaw stepped down. We're going to listen back to a 1998 interview with Peter Jennings. He had just co-authored a book chronicling the major events and changes of the 20th century. I asked him how he'd seen journalism change since the early 60s when he started working in television.
Technology, I think, has probably changed my business more in the last 10 or 15 years than it has since the invention of radio and television, because it has obligated us to work with such speed now that sometimes we don't even have time to stop and think what we're doing. I don't think a lot of people necessarily agree with me, but I think that in some respects reporting has been made much more difficult with the advent of instant technology all over the world. When I was a young reporter living in the Middle East, I could go to India, as I did, for example, in 1971 to cover the Indo-Pak War, and I would go off in the morning and cover something, and then I would take the film and I'd send it down to Dum Dum Airport at Calcutta, and someone would hand carry it to Bangkok if I were lucky, and then hand carry it on to Tokyo where they'd process it and put it on the satellite to Los Angeles and landline it to California. It was the process just to get the film back. I could then go on reporting for another 12 or 14 hours and go to downtown Calcutta and rent a radio station from or rent a radio studio from All India Radio, just like sitting here today, write my copy with a far greater measure of perspective, I think, than I would have the opportunity today, where I would just simply punch my camera in or my tape recorder in and just go live. So the perils of going live are very demanding for reporters.
It seems to me the role of the anchor has changed somewhat since you started in broadcasting. Your first stint as an anchor was it 1963, 65?
No, 1965.
1965.
I used to do it in short pants.
You mean because you were so young?
Precisely.
Right, yeah, you were, what, 26 or something?
Not to mention unqualified, yes, 26.
Yeah, that is, even by today's standards, very very young for an anchor. What was expected of an anchor then that's maybe different from today?
Well, what I was an anchor then was to somehow fit in the general overall trend of the ABC television audience at the time, which was young. I think Gidget was the number one show at the time when I was doing it, and I was the youngest guy around. I had my hair and my teeth. Ironically, some things haven't changed. I was expected to write a lot on the evening news then. I didn't do it very well. The anchor person is, in most news organizations, now most of the major news organizations, now a very senior editor. And so I'd be one of the two or three senior editors in the whole news division now, certainly the senior editor on my own broadcast. You're also expected to do an awful lot of live programming and be available to do an awful lot of live programming, to anchor, in my case, all of the political coverage as well. Sometimes the burden, I think, on the anchor person is rather too much. It sounds a little self-indulgent, but when I got this job the second time round after having been a foreign correspondent for 20 years, I thought that I would, you know, read magazines instead of newspapers now and books instead of magazines. And it's a much more demanding job hour by hour than I had thought it was going to be, because it has so many components to it.
Do you write your own copy?
I do on the evening broadcast, either write or rewrite almost all of it. I do it for a variety of reasons. I do it because it's very subjective, so if you find someone who writes exactly like you do, it's pretty unusual. It's a great way to copy edit as well and check for facts. It's a great way to add perspective if you've had any experience on a particular issue.
I find your copy really very kind of clear and concise and direct.
It wasn't always thus. Oh, God, I had a producer once many years ago who gave me a Christmas present on common English usage. I was just
what was your problem?
Well, it may be the way I speak sometimes. I would make for lousy sound bites. I tend to use a lot of inverted phrases and ifs, ands, wherefores, and maybes, because that's rather the way I look at life. And so I find writing the evening news sometimes very challenging, because I realize that what we're trying to give folks in the evening is black and white, when so often I want to give them gray.
I used to live in Buffalo, so I recognize the Canadian out and about, which is right. a little different than the American out and about. And so I'm wondering, when you started anchoring, whether you were given any heat about the kind of Canadian vowels.
I was, indeed. Mind you, I, knowing you're from Buffalo reminds me that when I grew up in Toronto, we wanted something exciting to do, we went to Buffalo. Now you grow up in Buffalo, you want
right.
something exciting to do, you go to Toronto. When I came down from Canada in the early 1960s, I was, looking back on it, I was incredibly pompous and determined. And so I did think I could get away with saying things like lieutenant instead of lieutenant and bean instead of bin. And but it's pretty difficult after all those years to change outhouse. I've got rid of most of them now, but as I really am amazed that people put up with me as long as they did in those early days.
Having come from Canada, does it strike you that Canadian and U.S. culture are much different or very similar?
I think they're both very similar in many ways and very different, I think, in some ways for some people. And to some extent, that may be generational. You know, in the United States, we grow up with the notion of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Canada, you grow up to a greater extent with citizenship, good government, and never cross a street against a red light. I took my son up to a World Series game in Toronto when the Blue Jays were in the World Series, and we had an awesome evening, and the Blue Jays won, and there was quite a lot of beer consumed, and we all came out of the Sky Dome in Toronto. And as I said, a lot of beer had been consumed, and one cop on Front Street put up his hand, and we all stopped. And I thought to myself, boy, home again. But yeah, so I think very different. And I also think that this is very true about Canadian journalists who've come here. Canada is a very large country with a small population living next door to a large country with an enormous population, which has made such an extraordinary difference in the world, especially in this century. And so I think that Canadians have a slightly more refined notion of the value of influence. Americans grow up with a sense of power, and Canadians are obliged by their state to grow up with a sense of influence.
I'm wondering if there is anything that that is common now in television journalism that violates the rules that you were taught when you were first coming of age in television journalism.
Well, I think it depends a lot on your background. I grew up, my father was a great broadcaster in Canada, one of the early broadcasters on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, has always done in Canada what NPR does here. He beat it into my head as a child that you didn't invade people's privacy unless there was a very demanding reason for it. And the demanding reason, for me, is invariably an impact on public responsibility or one's public job. So the greatest difficulty I have in general is invading someone's privacy. Have had my own invaded on more than one occasion. And so I rather wish there was a way in which we could all draw back somewhat and have, if not, you can't abandon it, of course, but if people who did this sort of thing paused every time they were thinking about invading someone's privacy for circulation reasons and could have some clear understanding of what impact that might have on that person's life.
Something that I think might have changed since the days you started in television, I think it used to be considered a violation of the rules on television if a reporter was also a news analyst. And now, for instance, Sunday morning, Cookie Roberts and Sam Donaldson are news analysts and freely give their opinions, but then during the week they're reporting on Congress and the White House, respectively. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, I think it depends, to be perfectly honest. In some respects, I'm Sam and Cokie's editor on the evening news, and one of the things that impresses me about both of them is that they are able to work as analysts and commentators on Sunday, and yet I defy the audience to discover where they're not acting as reporters, unless I ask Cokie, for example, to be an analyst in the course of the week on the evening news. One of the things that's always impressed me about Sam Donaldson, and I think has impressed almost everybody he's ever covered, is how fair he is. I think in all of these instances where reporters are sometimes analysts and, I grant you, sometimes columnists, the most effective thing the audience can do is to just bear it in mind. I try to explain to people, you know, that we all have bias. We all have baggage. I am a white, middle-aged man from the former British Commonwealth with very little education, very little formal education, and some strong biases about some strong issues. I want people to be aware of those so that when they watch and listen to what I do, they know where I'm coming from. I also like people to understand that the bias you see or you think you hear and see in journalism is far less prevalent on the air than it is in the selection process of what we do. I give you one example. I've been very interested since the beginning of the AIDS crisis in the burden that AIDS is on the society as a whole. And I was very lucky. I worked on a series for public television when it was a scare subject. And so I learned a lot thanks to the program called the AIDS Quarterly on which I worked. And as a result, I have a very strong notion that AIDS is a national issue and I want to get past all the bias points. So I'm very happy that people understand that bias and when they see something on our air about bias. But I think the audience should think that about everybody, that they should understand that we all have some baggage. And that's okay. We would be very boring people if we didn't have baggage.
We're listening back to a 1998 interview with Peter Jennings. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to an interview with Peter Jennings. He died of lung cancer yesterday. He was 67.
Now, your father was in the news business, I think at the CBC in Canada.
He was.
What did he do?
He was the first national radio anchor person or anchor man that Canadian radio ever had. And so 50 years ago, no, God, no, 60, 70 years ago, my father was doing the national news on the radio for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, coast to coast every night. And he did all of the live broadcasting, too, for the opening of Parliament and great state events. I learned from my father about live broadcasting. And I learned a lot from him. I learned, which I'm not giving a very good example of today, I learned to let other people talk and silences to have as much impact. I love, for example, covering funerals. I learned how to cover a funeral for my father, who used to say to me, "Be sure we hear the horse's hooves."
In other words, stop talking for a while.
Stop talking for a while and let people hear the gun carriage go by.
Well, what you did early on in 1965 was to anchor for ABC, as you said, at the age of 26. This was after Frank Reynolds' death. And I think you were opposite Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley.
Mm-hmm. I was at a lunch once with Chet and David. Chet, as you know, is dead now. Walter Cronkite is still a good friend, had been immensely kind to me when I'd come down from Canada. We went to a lunch here in New York, Chet Huntley and Walter Cronkite and young Peter Jennings, and some man stood up in the audience and said, "You know, you guys are just like you, Harry, you guys are just in show business." And Brinkley drew himself up to his haughtiest height and said, "Excuse me, the only concession I make to show businesses is on the way to the studio, I stop in the makeup room, and I have these bags under my eyes painted out." And Cronkite piped in, "Yes," and Jennings stops in and has them painted on. That's how young I was.
Did you feel very uncomfortable? Did you feel like you were like the young, handsome guy who was cast in this position because he was young and handsome?
Well, I did it for 3 years. For the first 2 years, I was too stupid to feel awkward about it, which meant I was probably too full-headed. And by about the end of the second year, just before the Arab-Israeli War broke out in 1967, I realized enough already. I hated it. I went off to the Middle East at the end of the 1967 war and came back to my employers and said, "That's enough. I want out of here." And they said yes, very eagerly, I realized. I think that would have been only a matter of time before they'd have fired me. And off I went. And I never thought I'd come back. I never thought I would anchor again. because I was so happy for the intervening 20 years.
One of the things you did as a foreign correspondent was you opened the Beirut Bureau, mm-hmm. which was the first ABC bureau in an Arab country, and mm-hmm. you were there for, I think, 7 years?
Oh, 6 years.
Tell me why ABC opened a bureau there at the time.
Well, I think we were very self-conscious at the end of the 1967 war that the press corps had rather cheered for the Israelis and got to the end of the war and realized that there hadn't been much coverage from the other side. The only person we had on the other side of any significance was Charles P. Arno, a wonderful foreign correspondent who died just a few months ago in Arizona. And he'd been in Cairo, and the Egyptians had put him on a train, sent him to Alexandria, and before he knew it, he was on a Greek island. And I think that people felt that that the whole region was not being covered with as much balance or as interest as we might have, because the region, as you know, after 1967 got very, very, very interesting. And so I was living in Rome, going back and forth, and they said, we'd like you to go and live in Beirut. I said, no, I live in Rome. And they said, we'd like you to go live in Beirut. And I said, excuse me, you don't understand me. I live in Rome, Rome, eh? And was having an awesome time. When they said it the third time, I said, yes, quite. And I went and lived in Beirut. Of course, turned out to be even better than Rome. But I had as my responsibility for all those years everything east of the Mediterranean, all the way to India. And at India, the Hong Kong correspondent picked up. So I had all of the Arab world. I had the territories that were occupied by Israel. I had Greece, and I had Cyprus, and occasionally Turkey. I had Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, I was thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Well, one of your colleagues, Charles Glass, was kidnapped in Beirut, and I think you were anchoring the news at that time, and probably you were anchoring when the footage was played of him making a kind of forced confession,
mm-hmm.
I think about what being tied to the CIA or something, which,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah, Charlie was here. Yeah, Charlie was here the other day. He's more than a colleague of mine. I trained him.
Mm.
I took him to India as a sound man. I never forget, he used to carry the microphones in his socks. We get in front of some very important person we have to interview, and there'd be Charlie shaking out his socks so that the microphones would fall out onto the floor. So he was much more, but indeed he was kidnapped in Lebanon in the process of writing a book, and he'd planned to write a book about going from the Syrian-Iraqi border or Syrian-Turkish border down into Egypt and writing a wonder, which he wrote a very good book called Tribes with Flags, but it got interrupted when he was kidnapped in Lebanon. And I was on the air here doing the stock market crash or the stock market Black Tuesday. And suddenly somebody put on the air this picture of Charlie confessing to being a CIA agent, and it just, it's one of the few times I think I ever lost it on television.
How much did you lose it?
Enough to have to apologize to the audience minutes later.
Were you seeing this footage for the first time?
I was seeing it for the first time. It was a producer's mistake in some respect. Somebody should have told me it was in the house and we could have looked at it in a break, but they didn't. They rushed to get it on the air. And so I saw it cold for the very first time. It was very hard.
What were you seeing?
Charlie sitting there looking like hell, admitting that he was a CIA agent. And I could see, I knew the situation so well, I could just see the guy standing just off camera, just out of frame, you know, with their AK-47s or whatever pointed at him. Yeah, it was very tough.
I imagine that there have been other times when you've been anchoring live news coverage of something and a story has broken that has been greatly shocking and you were kind of narrating the story as it happens. Yes?
Yeah, I don't want to portray myself as being cold-blooded, but I've had other times. I remember when Ronald Reagan went down to the memorial service for the Challenger families after the Challenger disaster, and he went to Houston, and President Reagan, as you know, who had this extraordinary capacity to comfort people. Bill Clinton has some of the same, but Ronald Reagan could hold a mother in his arms, albeit briefly, and you could feel the comfort oozing out of him, not only for the individual, but for the country. And in the background, whatever band it was playing, the Navy hymn, and I just thought that was too much for me. But in the main, I've always felt very strongly, I was trained to believe that expressions of emotion, other than happiness has always seemed to be an acceptable mood to communicate. But I never thought it was my job to have other people know precisely how I was feeling about anything on the earth. They have enough trouble dealing with their own feelings.
When is happiness okay?
I think at the end of the news, if a story that we've done is clearly funny, or if Or if I can feel people around, if I've written a closing item to the broadcast and people around me smile, I think it's okay for me to smile. I just don't think it's, I think that crying on television is a bit demeaning to everybody, but mostly to the audience.
One last question. When you first anchored the news in 65, was there anything that was different about the nature of stories, their length, their content, what qualified as an appropriate news story compared to now in...
Oh, no, I think if you go back and look at those days, I occasionally hear my friend Don Hewitt at CBS, who from whom I learned a lot, railing about the old days. If you go back and look at a newscast from the 1960s or the 70s or even the early 80s and compare on a good day to what we do today, we're doing an infinitely better job today. Our techniques are better. Our reporters are much more specialized today than they were 25 years ago. The ability to communicate a story is vastly greater. People used to laugh at us for the graphics innovations of the news program, but in fact graphics have enabled us to communicate much more complicated stories. If you watch, we do a series on World News Tonight. John McKenzie, one of our medical reporters, do some of the most avant-garde medical reporting there is on television. They could never do it without graphics, but because we now have the computer age graphics that we do, it's totally easy to understand stem cells and how they work and DNA. And that would never have happened 20 some odd years ago.
Well, Peter Jennings, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, very much. Thank you for giving us the time.
Peter Jennings, recorded in 1998. He died of lung cancer yesterday. He was 67. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including Masterpieces of Western Music, Classics from the Baroque to the Modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lucifer's Shadow, a novel of passion and danger set in Venice by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Paul Anka talks about his years as a teen idol in the late 50s and early 60s. And we talk about his latest CD featuring swing versions of rock hits of the 80s and 90s by groups like Nirvana and R.E.M. Also, we remember Ibrahim Ferrer, the Cuban singer rediscovered by Ry Cooder as part of the Buena Vista Social Club project. Ferrer died Saturday at the age of 78. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Anka was a teen idol in the late 50s and early 60s. He wrote most of his hit songs like Diana, You Are My Destiny, Put Your Head on My Shoulder, and Puppy Love. After outgrowing the teen idol identity, he wrote the song that became Frank Sinatra's anthem, My Way. And at Johnny Carson's request, Anka wrote the theme for The Tonight Show. He returned to the top of the charts in 1974 with the hit You're Having My Baby. Now Anka is making a comeback doing other people's songs, songs few people expected he'd even care about. His CD, Rock Swings, features swing versions of rock songs from the 80s and 90s by bands like Nirvana, R.E.M., The Pet Shop Boys, and Van Halen. Rock Swings debuted at number 2 on Billboard's jazz chart. Here's Anka's version of Bon Jovi's It's My Life.
This ain't a song for the brokenhearted. Silent prayer for the faith departed. I ain't gonna be just a face in the crowd. You're gonna hear my voice, I'll shout it out loud. It's my life, and it's now or never. Ain't gonna live forever. I just wanna live while I'm alive. It's my life, my heart's an open highway. Frank said it, I did it my way. Just wanna live while I'm alive. It's my life.
That's Paul Anka from his new CD, Rock Swings. Paul Anka, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to cover songs from the 80s and 90s? It's like not your period.
Very simple, actually, and I don't know that they're covers in the true terminology. A cover record from whence I came in the 50s is to pretty much emulate another record. All songs out there, whether they be from the 40s or 50s or of standard quality or whatever, you know, they're all fair game in terms of re-records. I've done the old standard route for many, many, many years. I realized that there was a window out there for swing music. And when the record company came to me to do a swing album, I said, well, you know, certainly I'm indigenous to that world. I've hung around Sinatra. I know all those arrangers. I grew up with those people. But it's somewhat been done to death, and you have a young cult of guys doing it who probably don't even understand it, but it just seems to be the thing to do. I said, there's some real great music from some great bands and some great artists from the 80s and the 90s. And that demographic have grown up, and I think that a hit is a hit, a good song is a good song, and I don't think that we should pigeonhole music. And I said, within my mind's eye, as a musician and a songwriter, there are some songs out there. So I went in and recorded it, and it evolved, and it worked out.
Now, I'm a big Sinatra fan. I really love so many of Sinatra's recordings.
So am I.
Well, I knew that. One of the Sinatra recordings I don't love is Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. You know, mm-hmm. I think sometimes when Sinatra went into rock, it didn't quite work. Though mm-hmm. the truth is, I don't like the original of Bad, Bad Leroy Brown either, so right. Maybe that's not a great example. But were you concerned that some of your records might sound like Sinatra doing Bad, Bad Leroy Brown?
Good comparison in a sense, not an analogy to this. And I agree with you, that's not one of my favorite records, even though Don Costa, who I introduced him to, did that arrangement. I don't think that it's the same. I think that, you know, I looked at this stuff honestly and picked songs that I felt that I really got into and that I was motivated. You know, Sinatra went in and did a lot of those songs as just a throwaway. You know, they were just one take like his films. He wasn't really into it. He did it because he felt, you know, in some cases it would sell records. I didn't look at it that way. I felt that, you know, coming as a songwriter and a musician, unlike Sinatra, I knew what to do with them as a songwriter. I knew how to work with them as a musician to make them personally mine. You know, we can't look at it as religious fanatics as to music.
One of the songs you do on the new CD is Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, probably their most famous record. Mm-hmm. What did you hear in this as a potential swing song?
Well, it started with the assessment of the charts. When I looked at all the Billboard, you know, I saw the importance of grunge, you know, that whole Seattle movement. The Nirvana record is an anthem. He's a poet in a sense. You know, I understood it intellectually and what and where it was coming from. But when I looked at it, I said, you know, wouldn't it be wild if I could find the groove for this? Because I saw it right away in its melody structure. As a musician, I saw da 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 ba ba da ba. It does swing. The only thing I had to get over was to assess, you know, lyrically, how much of it, because I left a lot of the song out, how much was I going to use? How did it lay into this real swing shout that is probably one of the best swing shouts on the whole CD are those two instrumental releases. You know, I heard that, and that really hooked me. So I really selected the lyric that when I sung it would be at least believable enough for me once I got it into the pocket. But I knew it was an important challenge. I knew the importance of the group, and I just had to do it. And I've since heard from Dave Grohl, who's with the Foo Fighters, who was a part of the band, and he heard it. He heard me do it on Letterman, and then he heard the record, and he said, man, you know, I didn't recognize that lyric for about 20 seconds, but what a classic and great arrangement and the treatment. He went on and on about it. The reason I say that is because I felt in my heart that, you know, we're all creative people here. We're all part of that mosaic. And if I can create that and take a song that, you know, no one felt really had a chance to go there and really impress one of the guys that wrote it or that was a part of it, then my job is complete. And I've made a huge point there as to not pigeonhole that a good song's a good song.
Well, why don't we hear the original Nirvana version back-to-back with your new swing version of Smells Like Teen Spirit. And this is
okay.
This is Nirvana followed by Paul Anka from Paul Anka's new CD, Rock Swings. That was Smells Like Teen Spirit, performed first by Nirvana and then by Paul Anka, as featured on Paul Anka's new CD, Rock Swings. Oh, Paul Anka, the problem with that lyric as a swing song, and and I know other people have pointed this out too, is you know you don't really hear the lyric that clearly on the original record, but when you sing a mulatto, an albino, a mosquito, my libido, yeah, it's just, I don't know that the lyric is meant to be heard that clearly or kind of swung that way. How did you feel?
Well,
what did you do to try to make that part of the lyric work for you?
Well, I think the key is it is what it is. You know, you can look at abstract art or poetry or of any kind, and, you know, you have to respect, you know, the person that created it. Originally on the original record, you know, the way they mix those records, it's not necessarily let's hide the lyric. The fact is, it is the lyric to the song, and I think that those that grew up with the song, hearing it this way, not unlike taking a film from way back and modernizing it, it's the same analogy. You can't go changing the lyric, but there are people that have identified with it, that understood the original record, and that, you know, you can't sit down and hand out a pamphlet every time you record something as to what it means or what you mean by it. It is what it is. It swings. Those are the words. And if it's poetry in a sense, take it for what it is.
Paul Anka's new CD is called Rock Swings. We'll talk about his years as a teen idol after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Anka, and his new CD, Rock Swings, features his new swing versions of rock hits from the 80s and 90s. How old were you when you knew you wanted to perform? I mean, you were a star in your mid-teens.
Mm-hmm. I was around 12 or 13, I realized that I had a talent for writing. I was working, you know, around that period at the local newspaper, at the Citizen, and with the editor, Mr. Finn, and wrote some short stories in school and won some awards. So I started as a writer, and then what evolved was I started typing 60, 70 words a minute and then taking shorthand, and hated shorthand, got thrown out of that and put in a music class because I was a fan of music, and started taking piano and drums, and just around that age, 13, 14, 15, realized that, you know, I could play the piano, and then I started taking these poems that I'd written and started writing songs about it, and then started working in you know, local plays around town in the school, started a group called the Bobby Soxers. So I was this huge music fan. From that window, from 13 to 15, you know, realized that there was this fire in my stomach, and I pursued it from there.
Your first hit when you were 16 was Diana, which was produced by Don Costa, who later mm-hmm. became Frank Sinatra's arranger and producer. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he'd been doing arrangements for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. How did you meet Don Costa?
Well, I left Canada, where I was living at the time, and I wanted to get to New York. I'd already been there prior to meeting Don Costa because I knew that's where the music was. I won a contest collecting soup wrappers for Campbell's Soup. There was an ad in the paper for IGA Food Stores, and it said that if you collected these soup wrappers and put your name behind, put it in the box, that you could be selected, on and on and on. So I won. I got a job at IGA, clocked all the cans leaving, went to the houses. Anyway, I win from my district.
Wait. So you got this job just so you could collect more soup cans?
Uh-huh.
Wow. That's so ambitious.
I was a very ambitious young man. And I won the contest, and I went to New York with 40 other guys from Canada, and a little box lunch, went to the YMCA. They put us up, and I really got a sense of the scene down there, Alan Freed, the rock and roll, everything that was happening. So I knew I had to get back there. I had some friends of mine who had a hit record at ABC Paramount called the Rover Boys, song called Graduation Day. And they steered me over to
Was
that
Will
Costa.
Remember Always Graduation Day?
Uh-huh. It was a big hit back then. And I was a fan of the Rover Boys, as I was for the Crew Cuts and Four Lads. So I went up to see Don Costa, and he saw this young kid walk in, you know, T-shirt, jeans, in a time when, you know, that wasn't the thing. It's not, you know, like it is today, where you've just got this rash of kids running around making records. And he said, okay, play me something, because they were a new company. And I sat down and just started banging away at the piano, and I played Diana and Don't Gamble with Love and a couple other songs, and that's where it all started. He, you know, said, where's your parents? In Canada. Can we fly them down? Blah, blah, blah. And we signed a contract, and that was the beginning for me. I never went back.
Okay, the song Diana, the lyric is, I'm so young and you're so old.
You're
this
so
is my
old.
Darling, I've been told. I've read this was basically about your babysitter.
Well, she sat a couple of times for my brother and sister, but she wasn't on an ongoing basis. She was someone I saw at church. You know, new in the community, small community, Ottawa, mm-hmm. Canada. And I saw her from afar most of the time, and then I would, you know, run into her socially at certain gatherings. But back in the 50s, unlike today, you know, if you were older by a few years, if you were taller, if you didn't have a shot. You know, that's what it was back then. And she was all of those things. And but I had this little crush on her, and thus, I'm so young and you're so old. I would play it at parties for my friends. The word would leak out to her, and she thought it was rather cute. I mean, there was no real spiking of emotion there. And I just went on with it, and I'd put it in my pocket and just kept writing until I had the chance to. You know, originally I started playing those songs for these groups that would come to town, including Chuck Berry, and nobody really paid any attention to me. And that kind of really motivated me to go on and sing my own songs. And that was my first record.
Well, why don't we play it? This is from 1957, Paul Anka singing his song, Diana.
I'm so young and you're so old. This, my darling, I've been told. I don't care just what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I will be as free as the birds up in the trees. Oh,
That's Paul Anka, recorded in 1957. He has a new CD called Rock Swings that features his swing versions of rock classics from the 80s and 90s. Now, in 1958, I remember hearing your hit, You Are My Destiny, which starts with this big orchestral flourish and a chorus singing, Destiny, Destiny. And, you know, I must have been around eight, and I thought, I don't know what destiny means, but it sure sounds important. Did you have any sense when you were like 17 writing the song of like the bigness of the emotion saying you are my destiny?
I was aware of it. It was, you know, a part of just, you know, evolving as a writer and really kind of setting a new kind of trend, because most rock and rollers weren't really into the big orchestras. And you know, that record actually was a case in point to Buddy Holly, who was a very good friend of mine, who wanted to change his style and, you know, was leaving the Crickets and told me that, you know, he was just being robbed blind by a manager and wanted to change, but he wanted to make a record like You Are My Destiny. He was very impressed with it. And he wanted to do It Doesn't Matter Anymore, a song that I wrote for him, with the large orchestra. And that was the last session that he did before he went down on that plane on our sister tour.
Wow. Why don't we hear You Are My Destiny, and this is 1958, Paul Anka. That's my guest, Paul Anka's big hit from 1958, You Are My Destiny. And Paul Anka has a new CD called Rock Swings that features rock songs by people like Bon Jovi, R.E.M., all recorded in a swing style. I want to ask you about another hit that you had in the 50s, Put Your Head on My Shoulder. And this was a big expression at the time. And, you know, yes. If a girl put her head on her boyfriend's shoulder, that was really a sign of their growing intimacy.
Yeah. Commitment.
Commitment, yeah. Now, I don't know that I've heard that expression in decades. I mean, was that already a big expression when you wrote the song?
It was certainly, a physical act. I don't know that we used it that much, and obviously it doesn't prevail today. But what all that was about, I was really writing everything that I observed. Whether it was Lonely Boy, Put You on My Shoulder, I remember very clearly. I would, you know, I'd be the guest of these disc jockeys. Back then you'd record something and be invited to sing at a high school. And all I saw when I went to these high schools was everybody, the ultimate game was to get your head on somebody's shoulder, whether it was there or in a movie house. You know, you'd take a girl to see a movie, and for the first 15 minutes you'd worry about navigating your arm around her shoulder. And then the next 15 minutes was to get that head on your shoulder. So it was a big deal back then. And, we all knew it as kids. And when I would go to these dances and sing and be alone up on that stage, ultimately those that got there, I saw those heads on each other's shoulders. And that was like the cool move of the time.
Why don't we hear some of Put Your Head on My Shoulder? This is Paul Anka.
Put your head on my shoulder, hold me in your arms, baby, squeeze me oh so tight, show me that you love me too, put your lips next to mine.
We'll talk with Paul Anka about writing My Way and the Tonight Show theme in part two of our interview, which we'll hear later this week. Anka's new CD is called Rock Swings. Coming up, we remember the Cuban singer Ibrahim Ferrer. This is Fresh Air. In the late 90s, the musician Ry Cooder went to Cuba in search of older musicians who had been popular decades ago but had disappeared from the public eye because of the embargo and because their music was considered old-fashioned. With the help of bandleader Juan DeMarcos, Cooder found some great musicians and organized them into a band called the Buena Vista Social Club. He produced a CD by them, and that led to a documentary film. One of the musicians who caught on and recorded subsequent solo albums was the singer Ibrahim Ferrer. Ferrer died Saturday in Havana at the age of 78. Here's Ferrer singing Dos Gardenias from the Buena Vista Social Club CD.
Dos gardenias para ti, con ella quiero decir, te quiero, te adoro, mi vida. Ponle todas tu atención, que serán tu corazón y el mío. Dos gardenias para ti, que tendrán...
In 1998, Ry Cooder produced a solo album by Ferrer. I asked Cooder what kind of music Ferrer was playing when he was a young man and what happened to him when he stopped performing.
When he was active, you're looking at the post-war era, so let's say 40s and more like 50s and 60s. This is the era of the bolero and the kind of romantic tenor singing that was popular during those years in Latin American music. And Ibrahim is, I suppose, the last great bolero singer. This is a style that died. It was killed off by gross commercialization and guys in silk shirts and gold chains, and the beauty and the incandescence of the music seems to have, I don't know, it fell on hard times, and there again, you know, a style can just disappear. But when we asked Marcos, does anybody still sing this way, this beautiful high tenor lyric voice, he says there's only one guy left, there's only one man. And this Ibrahim Ferrer, and he's hard to find, and he's on the street somewhere, and I'll go find him. Then he went out, and he came back 2 hours later with this really strange-looking fellow. He's just very skinny, moves like a like an old cat, you know, like some kind of aging cougar, with this Chinese face. He's part Chinese, very black, and a little cap and a cigarette. He said, "What do you want me for? I don't sing anymore. Who wants me?" And I look at this guy, and I could see he has this quality where his eyes don't move in his head. He's like an old guy from Mississippi, and I'm thinking, this is somebody. You know, this guy's heavy. Put him up in front of a microphone. Let's see what he's going to do here. And out comes this chocolate syrup voice like I think of Nat Cole. The rarest kind of vocal quality, and very rare in a person who's older, because age generally is not kind to that vocal quality. You know, the top extension in the voice is a thing that age starts to wear away. And not like me. and I think that, you know, it's bad pollution down there, and he smoked every day of his life and so forth, but he opens his mouth and out comes this angelic sound, and he's very inward and he's very zen-like, lived a life of poverty, and he'd never been known, he'd never had an opportunity to make his own records. Never had a record with his name on it, had been just not only forgotten but ignored the entire time. And he had no idea what we were doing. We were saying, look, we're making some songs here, we're trying to do something nice, it's good. Stick with us, you know, come back every day. You want me to come back? I said, yeah, I want you to come back. Every day he would say, you want me tomorrow? I said, I really want you tomorrow. And so pretty soon he began to realize that this was something that was serious, you know, that we weren't just carpetbagging and running off with the music. And it's a fantastic experience as far as I'm concerned, because I really never expected to be able to record this music in the world again, because nobody could sing it, as far as I was concerned.
Ry Cooder recorded in 1998. Ibrahim Ferrer died Saturday at the age of 78. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Usted por enamorado, tan viejo y tan poco.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the leader of the North American Islamic Council that issued a fatwa, an edict, condemning terrorism and saying it is forbidden by Islamic teachings. Also, we talk with Bill Maher. He has a new book collecting his new rules. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.